This episode of Therapy Insiders is sponsored by WebPT, makers of the awesome and super popular EMR software. Recently, I spoke with WebPT COO and co-founder Heidi Janangam, and I asked her, what really separates WebPT from other EMR companies?
Actually, I think we're the only EMR company that does not charge you a service fee for live calls. So we have, live bodies here right in Arizona that are taking our customers' calls when they have a problem, or answering emails when they send us a support ticket and they have a question about something.
WebPT, high-tech, awesome EMR, but with a human component. They're always ready to talk and listen. Check them out at www.webpt.com or give them a call for a free demo, 866-221-1870. Let them know Therapy Insider sent you. Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I'm Dr. Gene Schrockerbrod here with Dr. Joe Palmer, back from his hiatus from the previous episode, and Dr. Erson Religioso. How's everyone doing?
Doing well, Gene.
I'm doing well, Gene.
All right, so I'm a little bit hesitant, Erson, to let you introduce our last guest after your somewhat awesomely not awesome introduction of Chad Cook last time. Sometimes when something happens so slow motion, bad in front of you, just turns to awesome, which that was. I mean, it was great, and Chad was a good sport. So I'm kind of interested to see how this goes. So let's go ahead and let you introduce our next guest.
Well, our guest today is Julie Wiebe.
Right? Ah! Oh, Erson.
Oh, gosh, is it Weeb?
It's Weeb.
Man, I knew it was like 50-50. I'm trying to, like, what does she say in her YouTube videos?
It happens all the time.
So, you're 2 for 2. Awesome.
Our guest today is Julie Wiebe, one of the hashtag Pelvic Mafia, one of the founders. I don't even know how many of their...
Nobody knows, Erson. That's the point of the Mafia. Nobody knows.
There,
nobody knows.
Yes.
How
exactly.
That's right.
Great point, Joe. It's
that's right.
There could be thousands. There could be Pelvic Mafia living with you and you don't even know it.
Probably are.
That's right. Watch out.
So Julie is a women's health therapist, but she started off as a sports therapist, and then she has successfully merged both of those worlds. And as a women's health therapist, you might be thinking she gloves up and goes in like my wife used to do, but she has a very unique perspective on it, and she's very big into the core. And by the core, I don't just mean the TA, because that's also a misconception as well. And I think we'll touch upon a lot of those myths and misconceptions about the core and how you can do women's health without doing any intravaginal work, right? So I think it's a really fascinating topic, and she's big in, again, the core and breathing and alignment and what research many of us are not really privy to. So that's why I asked her on, and I think she has a great message and maybe something for CrossFit aficionados as well, right?
Yes, I hope.
So Julie, okay. Before we get into all your cool stuff, which there's a ton of, I really want to go back to your last name for a second.
Okay.
partly to give Erson a hard time.
I am the star of the outtakes. Yes.
The blooper reel.
Yeah, except for it's outtakes if Gene takes them out.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's never actually played at the end. It's played in the beginning for everyone to hear.
It's played throughout. Share for all.
I'm human, people.
Yes, yes, you are. Sometimes.
Very. Yeah.
So we had Sue on before, which is Sue Falsoni.
Yes.
Right, because we thought it might be Sue Falsone. You right. are Julie Wiebe, which
yes.
I'm sure you get Wiebe all the time.
All
now.
The time.
You know, Erson gave me a hard time. One of the reasons I'm giving him a little bit of a hard time, because he gave me a hard time about his name, last name before, because I would say Religioso. And
I didn't give you a hard time about it. I just corrected you. That's all. I mean, I got Religioso. I grew up in an Italian hometown. I got Religioso my entire life.
Religioso. So tomato, tomato, hard time, not hard time. Not to say, I mean, I don't have the easiest last name in the world, so I hear all kinds of things.
We can't all be Joe Palmers.
That's right. We can't. But believe it or not, this whole little monologue is going somewhere relevant, not just to make fun of Urson. It's just a cherry on top of all this. How often do you find your last name to be a very significant icebreaker with clients or patients that you work with and kind of use it as a positive to just, you know, have that little humor and laugh and really take off? Does that ever happen to you?
Well, actually, I find that people honestly just avoid pronouncing it rather than like go there. And I work with people regarding the pelvic floor. So there's plenty of ways to make people laugh without having to ever go to my name. So my name doesn't actually, I don't know. I guess maybe people are afraid to talk to me about it because they don't know how to pronounce it. But we get lots of stuff. Weber, Waibe, Waibe.
That would have been more fun for you, Urson, if you went yeah. that route. But you didn't. So you said pelvic floor, pelvic health. Sounds like there's a lot of interesting things that you can do in terms of patient interaction and some of the stuff that you treat. What made you want to get into pelvic floor stuff anyway? Because like Urson said in his awesome introduction that you did sports medicine before as well.
Right. You know, I actually feel like I got into women's health backwards, and I am not a traditional women's health therapist. I don't do any internal. I haven't ever taken the pelvic floor series. So I don't glove up at all. And so my kind of path into the pelvic floor was after my daughter was born. She's 12. And I really didn't know how to recover myself from a pregnancy. And so it was really my own exploration of trying to get myself better. And I didn't really have any typical women's health problems after I delivered, but I definitely didn't feel right. Things weren't right, and I wanted to get back into fitness. And so I found myself exploring the literature, and a lot of what was happening back then was the core. And that was, you know, when it was all sort of in its heyday and really just hitting the scene, because I don't know how long you guys have been therapists, but there used to not be a core. Like, there was no core when I was in school.
Oh, it seems like simpler times.
Yes, I know. We just called it lumbar stabilization. And but anyway, and so the pelvic floor was a piece of that puzzle. But we didn't really talk about it for a long time. We sort of just talked about the TA. And but I kind of was exploring the literature and recognizing that the things that I was sort of underutilizing elements of that system and overutilizing my more superficial system. And that's what was getting me into some of my, you know, day-to-day achy pains. And then I started to recognize the same pattern of recruitment issues with my 30 to 60-year-old female patients on my caseload. And these were women that were seeing me for, I was an ortho sports medicine PT. I had shoulders and knees and ankles and necks. And so I started to try to understand what they needed as it related to the lack of recovery that they had from their own pregnancies. I mean, these were now grandmas, but they were sort of operating on an unstable or a lack of connection to a sturdy foundation, a sturdy center that had ultimately led them to using their body in a way that with habit or compensation that had kind of led them to my doorstep for whatever, however that had fallen out. So really that was when I started to kind of build my approach, and all of them wanted to get back into some form of fitness. But back then, if you had a women's health related problem, and I'm putting that in air quotes that you guys can't see. You can feel it. Yeah. Like incontinence or prolapse or anything like that. If you had any issue like that, you should just simply stop doing fitness. And I didn't want to stop. None of my patients would stop when I asked them to stop. So it really became an opportunity to try to find a path for them. And, they weren't willing to take no for an answer, I guess. And so I felt like it was my job to help figure that out. And so that sort of led me down the path that I'm on now. And really, I just applied sports medicine concepts to the pelvic floor as a component of the core. So that's sort of kind of in a nutshell, my take and my approach.
What would you say, by the way, just because I know we're going to start throwing out movie quotes soon, because yes, we've gone back and forth all kinds of stuff on Twitter especially Tommy Boy. So I just pictured Austin Powers, This Is Me in a nutshell. so I'll fire off the first shot. But to talk core, let's talk about this for a little bit, because to me, this is probably one, if not the most common question I get asked in the clinic. What is the core that, you know, I should strengthen my core, or it's because of my core?
Right.
And 8 out of 10 people associate core with abdominals.
I say they all pat their belly when they
exactly.
say that.
Exactly. And part of it is wishful thinking, right? Because we associate things with common sense or common knowledge and hope that it leads to something else. Meaning that, you know, because I'm overweight, if I lose weight, I'll feel better. Because I have a weak core, if I have a stronger core, I'll have less back pain. And again, core, people think of, if I have a better core, one, I'll feel better. But two, a lot of people still have that thought of, I'll look better. Better core,
right.
Kill two birds with one stone. I'll have the six-pack abs. I'll look great. I'll feel great. And I'll feel better about myself. But that's not really the case. Core has very rarely ever justifiably been about abdominals. How would you, connecting sports and pelvic floor, women's health, and the entire, what I really like about your stuff is the patterns that you kind of talk about. How do you define, or how do you look at the core, and how do you explain it to your patients, to those that have a hard time explaining that?
Well, I start with, you know, how we talk about the core, and I always do air quotes in the clinic too. And I say, we've always talked about it as our abs. Well, we actually have new evidence that has shown us that that your diaphragm and your pelvic floor are part of the core. And you know, they kind of, their eyebrows raise. And I say, so that means how you breathe is important to how well your core functions. And that also means that what's going on with your pelvic health is a part of, gives us some indication of how well your core is functioning. And I tell them, I don't actually like to call it the core anymore. I like to talk about your central stability, your strength at the center. I don't actually like to say strength, I'm sorry, because I think I want to move away from the strength model in so many of the ways that we talk about stuff. But I tell them it's really, and it isn't even really about strength, but that stability comes from how well those three components are working together. How well your abs, your breathing, and your pelvic floor work together is really what sets us up for a better central stability. And then it sort of tumbles from there. But that's where I start. And I say, you know, we've really started to explore this. And I'll say to most of my patients, I'll say, so how is just focusing on your abs working out for you? You know what I mean? Like, and they're there because it hasn't. Like, I haven't in the last few years had as much trouble convincing people that it's not really about abs. Because they kind of have been trying a million crunches and they still don't have a flat tummy and they aren't better. You know what I mean? So they aren't as determined
Absolutely.
To hold on to that anymore as they used to be. They're a little more willing to explore things. But I'm also I'm sort of the end of the road for a lot of people. They find me after they've done 18 different types of practitioners. And so they're kind of willing to be more open to something new. Like, you know, I could say, I want you to stand on your head, and they'd be willing just because they've gotten to that point where they're just...
Not that you ever do that, because...
No, I don't.
Never.
Never.
Maybe
never.
Once, but after that, definitely never again.
Never. No, but you know, so they are more receptive, I think, because like, well, nothing else has worked. I might as well listen to this lady about breathing and, you know, my pelvic health, but...
Right. So you give them a new perspective and you justify it. And I kind of do the same thing. I always try to ask them a question, which is, well, what are your abs designed to do? Which, you know, most people don't really know, but it kind of gets them to really think about it. And I think once you get your patients to think about what they're saying, it really gets them going down the pathway of, okay, well, what are they designed to work for? And I usually tell them, you know, one of their main functions is just to keep your internal organs inside your body. And then I kind of tell them about different contractions, isometric, you know, fast twitch, slow twitch, and talk to them about, you know, your abdominals are kind of always on because they have to be, so your organs don't fall out of your body. So I ask them, like, well, does it really make a lot of sense to do crunches and contract, relax all the time for a muscle that's really designed as an endurance, always on type of muscle? And you could see the light bulbs going off and all kinds of things going on. And it works well to have that kind of conversation with patients.
Yeah, I really feel like the quicker I get someone's brain involved in what I'm doing, the better. And I really feel like in most of the cases that I get, like I said, I'm sort of the end of the road for a lot of people, is that they've really never been educated on their body. Like, they've just sort of been prescribed exercises without really necessarily understanding why they're doing it. And so so I really think that any time spent educating them on any piece of their puzzle is so positive.
Definitely. For sure. And that's a great point with educating and getting the brain involved. Erson, when you apply eclectic approach, you don't really focus on specific body parts, right? You kind of train it in patterns and movement patterns and look at the neurophysiological effect. How do you incorporate core and stability into, while using kind of eclectic approach mindset?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's all about explaining things and educating the patient in the simplest terms as possible. And I kind of scale up and down, and I always say you have to be kind of like Bruce Lee and flow like water, depending on the patient's understanding. So when I start off the core, and again, most people think it's the front, and maybe even a PT said them something about the back and the multifidi. I said, look, you know, you got to think of this as not just the front or the back, but think of it like a room, and how stable would a room be to hold up a ceiling, or you know, how stable would a floor be without walls all around? So I say it's got to have a front and a back and a ceiling and a floor.
Physical therapists are like masters of analogies. I love them too. I use the house one too. I don't know. Maybe we're all like handyman from another lifetime, because I feel like everybody uses house analogies, and I do the same thing. I always tell patients, kind of going with what you were saying earlier, Julie, with the pelvic floor being the foundation. I tell a patient all the time, if your foundation is always moving, you never know where the furniture is going to be when you come home. So you have to have a nice solid foundation. What about you, Jill? Like, how do you get patients that come in to buy in when you tell them, well, your core is not necessarily your abdominals, and they go, yeah, it is.
Yeah, well, I guess I use the box analogy, but I guess that says something about my house. I don't know.
Yeah, you live in a box. I've been to your house. It's not a box.
Anyway, yeah, I talked to him about the abdominals, and I tell him that while they're important, they're not necessarily the most important. They might be the most superficial. They might be what you see, but that's not what's gonna help relieve your back pain, right? And so getting them to understand the difference is, no matter how many crunches they want to do, they're never gonna see that six pack if it's under 30 pounds of fat. So I don't necessarily say it that bluntly, but I do make sure that they understand that it's not what you see, it's functional, and that's what we're working on.
And function involves, like you said, Julie, breathing. And a component of breathing, aside from the diaphragm, is also the rib cage. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like rib cage and ribs in general is one of the most underlooked or evaluated things in the human body, from what I usually hear about.
Nobody wants the rib cage. Nobody wants to own that. I had a patient today that she hadn't been having pain in her back, but apparently she had an episode, and she went through and she got every test in the book. I mean, she was having upper left back pain pain with deep breaths, and she got an EKG, she got a stress test, she got every test that they could do in the emergency room, they did on her. And and finally a doctor said, yeah, it's probably a rib. Go
$6,000 later, it's probably a rib.
Take this muscle relaxer and see how that works for you. So
for your rib.
Yeah, anyway, She was having muscle spasms corresponding to this subluxed rib. So anyway, today I mobilized it and she felt a lot better. And so, it's funny to me that nobody wants the rib cage. That's where that story comes from.
Julie, I do.
You want the rib cage. Tell us why you want the rib. Take the rib cage, Julie.
I will. You know what? I kind of think of it more globally, like the entire thoracic cage. But I mean, in terms of where I want to start with someone, which is to understand better, how, because the diaphragm lives in the rib cage. And so the position that the rib cage is in will have some capacity to dictate how well the diaphragm participates in the breath, like whether or not they're, it sort of determines whether or not they're overusing accessory muscles or like an upper chest breathing pattern, or if they're underusing accessory muscles and maybe having a more compressed chest position, like a big belly breather. And so I like to utilize and think through rib cage positioning as it relates to diaphragm function, because I think it has a major role to play in that. Because the diaphragm, one of the other things that I actually talk to my patients about related to the core, is that the diaphragm is actually what sort of leads the charge. We've sort of put the abs in the front seat for a long time, in the driver's seat, but all of those muscles of that system of that, the abs and the pelvic floor, they really run off the diaphragm. We have some good studies that have shown that relationship. And so what the diaphragm is doing is really critical to setting up the function of the rest of those components. So where the rib cage is actually a really critical thing that we need to start looking at, as rehab and fitness folk,
What is something about the rib cage we can look at? If somebody comes in, what will cue a clinician, or if somebody's listening that's not a clinician, apparently we have a couple of people.
Your mother and my mother.
You know what? We'll take whoever we can get. Mom, thanks for listening.
Yes.
So if somebody's listening and they've had pain, or they've had discomfort, or they've had incontinence issue, anything, what would make somebody think, hey, this might be related to my rib cage? And instead of being like most people and just going after the symptom of feeling it where it is, what would make somebody go down the road of thinking about maybe it's a little bit more than just pain in the butt?
Well, I would actually have them assess their own breathing pattern.
And how would they do that?
They can look in a mirror and take a breath. And so if they were looking in the mirror and they took a big breath, and I'm talking about a big breath, because then you can actually kind of pop out your pattern, and your breath goes up, like your shoulders rise or the rib cage rises up, then that would indicate, we would just simplify, that's a upper chest breath pattern, which I don't think anyone on this call or on out there would think was a good breath pattern. And then usually I find that happens when folks have what I like to refer to as a bell rung up rib cage. And so that's the way I talk about it with my patients, is that the rib cage actually acts like a bell ringing off your shoulders or your shoulder girdle. And so if your bell is rung up, so meaning it's rung to the front, that is when we tend to see that upper chest pattern. And then if you're rung down, that's sort of more that collapsed rib cage slouchy posture. And that tends to have more of a belly breath associated with it. I can change your breath pattern by asking you to do that. Like ring your bell up, and which would be, since I'm trying to describe it without any visual, like your sternum would kind of go up toward the ceiling, and take a breath, and you can feel how you're breathing, and then sort of let it collapse back so that you're slouching, and then take a breath there, and your pattern changes. And so we can actually change your breath pattern by changing your rib cage position. And that's kind of eye-opening to patients, that they would have that much power over how they breathe. And so I ask my patients, what I'm really gunning for is that you would have a quiet bell, and so that it would live quietly over top of the pelvis, meaning it's not rung into any extreme. And then I talked to them about why I want it there, which is so that it can have, it can enhance its interaction and relationship with the rest of the components of that core system and improve its excursion. Excursion's a really big deal. I mean, I'm using excursion as a word for you guys, but I wouldn't necessarily say that with a patient, but, so that's,
there's your mistake, using big words on us.
Oh, so you see, it goes down and up.
Yes. Got it now.
So I think that that's how I would do it, but it's also, so I don't know if that kind of answered the question and if I should bother adding to it, but,
yeah, definitely. Do you have, is there somewhere people can go and actually see what you just talked about?
I have online videos that are free access. So I do have some there. One of the things I usually recommend if you want to just kind of get introduced to the way that I think through things and talk about it. I mean, I have a ton of videos, but there's there's a Fit Floor series that sort of kind of highlights this. It's 1 through 3. I had intended to make it like 1 through 10, but I got stuck at 3. But that's there. I do have other online courses too that talk through some of these components as well, and sort of give it, more incrementally and theoretically.
And where are those courses available?
They are on my website at Julie Weeb. And Weeb.
That's Weeb, Urson.
Yeah, Weeb.
Right. I'm just going to say Jewel Weeb.
There you go. That's fine.
It's the Jewel-y, you know, that throws me off.
That's perfect. It's what's... excuse me. I have a little bit of a cough. But it's juliewebpt.com. And you can... Oh, shoot. Did I lose you guys?
No, you're still there.
Or interiorfitness.com. I used to love that website name.
But... You know, it's so funny. Nobody knows me like that anymore, Urson. But you and there's some others that are just like love that thing. But you know what? It got trademarked out from under me. So.
Oh, it did. Is that what happened?
That's one of the things that happened. Yeah. So
Helen, we're both in sales and you let something like that happen.
I know. You know what, though? A lot of people were like, what does that mean? So it didn't have as much value for...
Too clever.
Yeah, you know, it had value if you understood what I was doing, but if you didn't understand what I was doing, it was like, are you a trainer? Like, what? Like, there was no, you know, and back when I really started this whole thing, I mean, talking about the pelvic floor was like the best way to clear a room. You know what I mean? Like, no one was talking about it with me, really. So, you know, it's now it's like, people are talking about it, which is great. But anyway, so interior fitness kind of moved on. But back to the courses, you can access them on my website, juliewebpt.com.
There you go. Check those out. I've seen a few. A close friend of mine and physical therapist, Maureen Ambrose, she's been looking at your courses and looking at some of the cool Ribcage stuff. And she's like, hey, check this out. This Julie character. I was like, yeah, I know that Julie character. By the way, I'm disappointed in you that you just missed my Tommy Boy quote.
Which one?
Helen, we're both in sales.
Oh, I did. I missed it. I did it. The bun. Is that the bun one where he starts to, my naughty bun and rip up the bun? Isn't that the one? The waitress?
He's in the diner?
Yes. Okay, I got that. All right.
Also, Urson, okay. If you don't hear me talking for like 2 or 3 minutes, it's because I've passed out from practicing all the breathing stuff she was just talking about. Right,
you're just looking yourself in the mirror trying to expand your... Yeah.
I'm just sitting and breathing here. So if you hear silence from me for an extended period of time, Joe, Urson, please take over.
You know, yeah, but I think... one of the other things that I really think we need to talk about too, I mean, we collectively as PTs, is if you look... one of the things that we tend to classify, especially women, and especially my population, which is postpartum women, and pregnant women, is that there's sort of an assumption that they're anteriorly tilted and hyperlordotic all the time. Like, that's kind of a classification. And the reality is that the rib cage position that a lot of women find themselves in postpartum actually has tricked our eye, because the rib cage translates behind the pelvis. And especially that bell rung up position. And so we actually, I think the more we get real comfortable with looking at rib cage position, and I'm talking global, not like individual ribs, we can start to kind of recognize that a lot of these people that we think are hyperlordotic are actually demonstrating a rib cage position shift. And again, this is a little hard to demonstrate with just vocally, but one of the best ways that I found to kind of demonstrate that, and you can do this tomorrow when you go back to the clinic, is look at the apex of their lumbar curve. Like someone that you assume is anteriorly tilted, hyperlordotic, that apex should be at L4, which is where we have the most, that those vertebrae are designed for more shock absorption. And you'll find that the apex is higher on a lot of these people than you're anticipating. It's quite shallow through the lower lumbar curve, and it's actually a little bit higher. You'll find that it's up closer to the TL junction. And so if I find that, and I usually use what I call the elbow sign to help me find that, which
I like
is
it.
That,
clever.
Yes, that the T, that's right. Your elbow tends to be around your TL junction. And if your patient's apex is somewhere at like the level of their elbow, that's the rib cage that has shifted behind them. And that is tricking your eye. Like it's really easy to get tricked if you've never looked at the rib cage. Like it's really easy to go, oh, they have an anterior tilt hyperlordosis. They have tight psoas. You know what I mean? Because we haven't ever looked or considered that upper quarter contribution. And we name posture and alignment only by the lumbosacral, lumbopelvic area. Like we don't actually name it by any other contribution. But that rib cage position is huge. In terms of where the pelvis is and where the loads are coming from the upper quarter through that pelvis and lumbar spine area. So little something to test tomorrow.
Joe, I think she's owning the rib cage.
I am owning the rib cage.
She's owning the rib every rib cage.
There you go.
So this rib shift that you're talking about that changes the length tension relationship to the diaphragm, does that make it somehow like passively or actively insufficient? Because I'm trying to picture this without visualizations because I'm a visual learner, but I know that somehow this is changing the diaphragm so that it's inefficient. And then, you know, you haven't talked about the piston yet, so I'm trying to get, you know, segue into the piston concept.
Okay. I'm talking about it just without naming it, I guess.
Do share.
Well, the idea is that the interaction between the diaphragm, the tummy, and the pelvic floor, I just think there's a pistoning action. So when the diaphragm comes down, it pushes the organ south, which the pelvic floor and the TA need to open and give to that exchange of pressure, because when the diaphragm comes down, it's increasing our intra-abdominal pressure. And that pressure gradient creates a response, or it should, in the pelvic floor and the TA. They both should lower or elastically load in response to that pressure change. And then on exhale, when the diaphragm lifts, the TA and the pelvic floor take that elastic loading and they recoil more concentrically and then and more actively then participate concentrically participate in our stability cycle. So what that is really a dynamic relationship between those three parts that set up our stability, because we get inhalation stability based on that intra-abdominal pressure increase and counterbalanced by muscular force. And then on exhalation, it's that muscular force increase that helps us with our stability because the IAP is down. So it's a relative interplay between muscular force and intra-abdominal pressure that works together to create our stability. And it does it in a dynamic way. Like we all talked about kind of our analogies. One of the other analogies that I use for the core is gears in a machine, that they're constantly moving, constantly influencing each other's responses. And if you take a gear out of that machine, and you work that gear separate from the rest of the machine, neither the gear working separately nor the machine with the missing gear work well. Like you have to engage all of those gears and that in a dynamic way to really optimize that system. So the diaphragm, I don't really think it through, Ersin, as length-tension relationship. I probably should, but I think I just think of it in terms of excursion capacity. If you aren't getting that excursion from the diaphragm, then you have less of a pressure gradient change. How's that?
I have a feeling that this podcast is going to cause a lot of car wrecks because you're throwing out so much awesome information.
I just thought, wow, it sure sounds like she knows what she's talking about.
People are going to be like driving, either so focused on figuring out how to integrate everything or jotting down notes. And if you're listening to this while driving, for the love of God, please wait till you get somewhere to really take notes or focus.
Pause. Yeah, pause and come
just
back.
Continue breathing poorly until you get to wherever you're going.
Yeah. There you go. And go check out the videos. Go check out Julie's videos. And
a course.
It, yeah,
yes, go, she go also course. Teaches courses.
And please, for the love of God, don't kill yourself, because we like to keep the 8 listeners that we do have. And
oh, we're up to 8 this
we're
week.
We're up to 8, yeah, from last nice. One. Chad brought us like an extra 2, so we're trending up.
Perhaps it's time for a Tommy Boy quote to like bring it back to...
All right, holy shnikes, what do you got?
One mint for pillow. Now we're back. Okay.
And we're back. Yeah. So do you find when working with female athletes or athletes in general, because pelvic floor and the stuff you do, I'm guessing it's not just for females, right? Do you get males that come through as well with certain issues?
Yeah, you know what? I don't actually treat a lot of males. And part of that is because I am a solo practitioner and I treat out of my house and I live in Los Angeles. So I don't give out my information to random males that call me for appointments.
Probably a good idea.
Yeah. So that's just a decision that I've made. So I don't actually see a lot of guys. I do. My primary practice is females, and it's, it ranges from, you know, it's all over the place. Right now I have a really broad, swath of patients, but a lot of what I love is the ones that really want to get back into fitness, and they all want to get into some kind of fitness. You know, it just depends on what their goal is.
Gotcha. And, we have a few Twitter questions, but before we get to that, I'm kind of interested. Is setting up or practicing in your house, was that a hard thing to do? Was it awkward having patients, you know, even females, come to your house?
Yeah, it was. it was until I kind of created a better space separate from kind of the main house a little bit. Like I was able to kind of create my own space that made it with its own entrance, and that made it a lot better. That it wasn't quite so like awkward that you're walking into someone's actual, you know, like living space. So now I have kind of a separated situation, and it's a lot better. I think I feel more professional too. And I think it allows, one, I can keep it clean all the time.
Nice.
Yeah. And like the dogs aren't allowed yet to come into my office. And, you know, I mean, it's really, so I've been able to manage to create that. And so that's helped a lot. I had a mentor here in Los Angeles who did it that way. She had to close her practice for different reasons and brought it home. And it was the first, I was like, wow, I don't know if I would ever do that. And then when I lived in Canada, a friend, a colleague who became a friend, who is now my teaching partner, for the pediatric version of what I'm sharing. She did it out of her house as well. And, so I gave it a shot when we were in Canada, and it worked out fabulously. Like I didn't have a commute. I could like get the kids to school and get back and immediately see a patient or two before I had to go pick them up again. Like it was really, there are lovely things about it. There are pain in the butt things about it, but
what are some pain in the butt things about it?
I think like I still have to share one of my bathrooms. I don't have like a separate bathroom for patients, so I have to clean it every time I have a patient, even if I have one. Sorry, awkward. That's just, yeah, no, it's not awkward, it's just a pain. I'd rather, you know. But anyway, so you know, it's stuff like that. And I think you know, and then people know where you live, and no one's ever taken advantage of that, but it's just one of those things. I don't know. Overall, I think it's spectacular. And most of my patients really appreciate that I don't have a very clinical setup. Like it doesn't feel clinical. So I think it also helps put people at ease. There's a hominess to it because it's part of my home. And so I think like right from the get-go, I think people's experience starts out really differently because it is in my home. And,
gotcha. So, okay. Yeah. I thought it was unique. I've heard stuff like that before, and it's been interesting. I think it's an interesting model to practice. I mean, there's home PT where you go to other people's homes. So,
yeah.
You know, why not have home PT at your home? But, you know, things like, do you mark it with your address? Because people, you know, everyone will know where you live. And
I get people give me a hard time. They're like, I've been searching all over your website for your address. I'm like, yeah, I don't actually give it out. I actually don't even give my address out to the patients until I have a confirmed evaluation. Like, I mean, I'm pretty protective of that.
I thought you were going to tell me, like, they have to meet you at a certain parking lot while they go into a van. And
she blindfolds them.
Exactly.
It's like geocaching. I send out, like, a GPS coordinates, and they have to... Right. You have to follow their.
They go on a scavenger hunt, and eventually end up at your house.
But I think part of, like, for those people that are listening, part of the reason I do it the way that I've done it is because my real job is that I'm a mom, and I actually call this my secret identity. I really appreciate the ability to, like, you know, work within my motherhood, and having the practice at home really helps me do that. So,
wow, your kids don't know you're part of the pelvic mafia?
No, I don't think they've actually heard that. No, they've seen the t-shirt. Damn it, Urson. They've seen the t-shirt.
first the last name. Now you call her out. So now her kids know she's in the mafia.
That's right. That's right.
Actually, let's assume they even know what a podcast is, or they would.
Yeah,
they would
I told them I had an interview. They didn't really know what a podcast was, but actually, my children know a lot more about the pelvic floor than probably any 10 and 12 year old on the planet, except for every other 10 and 12 year old that has a pelvic mafioso as a mother. They probably all know about it, but so they know a lot about what mommy does, and
smart kids. But you said Canada, so let's bring this back to Canada for a second. Jason Bellafleur from Twitter at JasonBPT asked your question. He said, "Hey Julie, since you have a specific niche, how do you find new content for your blog? How do you keep things fresh?"
Well, I think. That's an interesting question. I think that I have not even scratched the surface with all the topics that I could cover. And part of that is because my niche spreads across two major specialties, like fitness and sports and women's health. So I have a lot to draw from in both of those worlds. And also I've got mommies that want to know what I've got different audiences as well that allow me to write things at different levels and for different people. But the other thing is questions that I get. Like, that's really the stimulus for so many of my my blogs, is I get tons of questions. And it's only every once in a while I'm like, shoot, I should have turned that into a freaking blog. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I always get on her back that she needs to blog more.
I know. Person does. I try. But I actually have like 80, three quarters of the way written blogs. But then I get, you know, I don't know, carpool and, you know.
Sidetracked. Life tracks.
Yeah.
But you do a lot of cool stuff. And you can, you know, I think we can comfortably call you an innovator. Like Joe said, you know, somebody needs to own the rib cage. And sounds like you're grabbing life by the ribs. we had another question from Scott McAfee at McAfee PT. He asked, as an innovator in both education and practice, what do you foresee being the next big thing for physical therapy? What do you see happening once we all unplug?
That's a great question. I'm not sure that I'm probably the best person to ask for the entire physical therapy community, but...
Well, we'll all chime in, all four of us, the four of us, we'll decide the future of our profession.
Oh, perfect. Right. Okay, good. I was going to say, that feels pretty weighty for one person. You know what? I'm not exactly sure what would be the next big thing, but I hope it's theoretical change. I think being on Twitter is really kind of been eye-opening over the years, but I think the en masse, like, adoption by so many DPT students has been kind of interesting to get a window into what they're learning. And I actually had some students on my course this past weekend when I was in Chicago, and it was really sort of fascinating because they're still getting, like, some of the things that we've talked about, they're still getting some of those old messages even now in school. And, you know, I'm hoping that in order to really innovate and change things up, we got to start with how people are coming out of school. And in my idea or my opinion, I guess, but that if we could start them thinking integratively, like from the start, that would be a really different outcome in terms of, you know, like for example, the strength model. That's something that I wish we wouldn't kind of be so, like, being 5 out of 5 does not mean you're well. Like, that's sort of the, like, as long as we get our patients back up to 5 out of 5, ta-da, they're healthy. But that's really not how it works. in the human body. And so stuff like that, but that's still what I'm getting with some of the tweets I see from some of the students. And then, you know, I just think we need to kind of theoretically kind of rethink some of the tenets. And we already are, like, pain science is changing and, you know, all sorts of things are changing, but we need, our educational process needs to reflect that, I think. So that, to me, I hope would be the, one of the next big changes we see in PT, is sort of changing up our educational model. But I don't really know what that would look like. Like, I don't know how to change that.
You know, that's one of the big things we've been talking about for a lot of, and in a lot of episodes. We, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, DPT students. It's a big audience of ours. They make up probably like 4 out of the 8 people that listen. So we
shoot, did I just alienate the 4 out of 8 people?
That's all right. They're a good bunch.
Maybe they're the ones that,
remember, two are your mom and my mom, so right, that they're okay. But they are very interested in what PT will be and what they want it to be, which is great, but they're kind of trapped by this foundation of what was, which right, is, which is a hard thing. So we talk to them about that a lot, and we've talked about different concepts and ways to improve that. And that, you're right, it's a hard thing to do, because they have requirements for their board exam and that they have to follow. But again, they're learning stuff that's either outdated or is just not good practice. Right. So it's a tough thing that we'll have to figure out a way to change, and knowing that it'll be over time, and no such thing as quick fixes in academia, right, Urson?
Yeah, you know, there's just, that's such a hard question to answer. And again, we tackle this frequently, and it has a lot to do with the antiquated education system, but also what CAPTI requires and what you have to know to pass supposedly what is entry level according to a national licensure exam. Right. And, you know, it's a licensure exam that still is heavily steeped in pathoanatomy and special tests and things that the literature is really getting away from. And it, you know, it's like you have to totally rewrite the CAPTI requirements and what the licensure exam tests you on. Otherwise, the curriculum's not going to change. Because my biggest message to students over the past 10 years has been, well, this is what you have to know to pass your board exam, and this is what you're probably going to end up doing in a clinic. And that's a very discordant message.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, I think that you're not going to change the system. The system itself, you're going to have to teach what is being tested. But the biggest thing that you can learn in school is how to be a learner, how to go get the new information, because that's how you continue to do your own research after you leave school. So you know, at some point it's got to be on the individual. You know, you're only in school for 3 years. Two, if we do the EIM thing. But
shout out,
what, Larry Benz. Anyway, what I'm saying is you gotta take some responsibility for it on your end, and really learn how to find the information that's coming out. Because if you wait for it to be processed through an educational system, you'll get it in 10 years when everybody else does.
Yeah, if they're lucky. And I think on Twitter we see a lot of very driven, initiative focused students that are on there that are interacting. Like Ryan wrote that nice blog piece about your course, Julie.
Such a nice piece. I was really excited.
Yeah, right. But Ryan is the exception, or Brooke, right, McIntosh, or TJ. Mm-hmm. Or Scott that asked the questions, you know, they are an exception to the rule, and which is a shame. And it's good to have them. But like Joe said, I mean, if you take initiative, even with CAPTI requirements, if you talk to your whoever does your courses stuff and say, hey, I know the lectures are set or everything is what it is, but how about you have this person come in to do a special lecture, or how about you ask this person to do a Skype lecture on business, on pelvic floor, on pelvic health, on rib cages, on things like that, contact Julie. Check out her content. Call Jerry. Jerry Durham, shout out. Talk about business and customer service. I mean, their minds will be blown for different reasons with Jerry. But
I laugh because I know what you mean.
It's funny because it's true.
Yes.
But they will be, you know, they will get a whole different perspective on what it means to be in business, or to be treating patients that have certain issues aside from tradition. So that there's ways to go about it, because there's always a couple hours within a curriculum that you can fit in things like this that are just either dead areas or just built in for off days or snow days or whatever. There's, you know, most of us have been in academia, and Urson's taught, I've done adjunct teaching. There's ways and schedules to build in that. So, go ahead.
I actually have a couple schools that use my online courses in their curriculum, which nothing in the regular curriculum. I'm always in the electives, but it's a start.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And it's great because it just offers a little bit more, I don't know, additional perspectives, I guess, is what you're saying.
Right.
So, yeah, no.
But that's still 1%. If there's, what, like 200-some PT schools in the U.S. and, you know, a couple use it, we're talking still. We're still talking the same population of DPT students that are taking initiative on Twitter. It's the same exact thing. So it's getting on there and pushing forward. I mean, Joe, if University of Maryland contacted you and said, hey, Joe, we'd like you and Gene to come in and do some courses or do a couple lectures on setting up a PT practice or business or being an entrepreneur, would you say no?
I would probably say yes.
Exactly. I mean, we would love to do stuff like that to help the students. And it's just, so here we go. Our hashtag Project PT for our, you know, hashtag DPT students. A lot of hashtags in one sentence. Reach out to your program directors. Yes. Tell them that you're interested in whatever you're interested in. If you've been listening to the show, you've seen the guests that we've had on, which have been pretty much the leaders in their field, in our field. And tell them that, hey, I want to have a lecture on business, or I want to have Julie do a Skype lecture on the rib cage and pelvic floor health and things like that. And tell them to email one of us if they have any questions, and we will make sure that it happens. We will either guilt trip the bejesus out of them into letting you have what you want, or we will just absolutely blast them on the podcast. So
well, that's a long hashtag. I think it's greater than 140 characters. How are they going to fit that all in? It might be.
Just hashtag Project PT. And,
okay, that's shorter. That's
tell funny. Them tell them about what we said, or have them listen, and let's get things moving. What do you say?
Amen. Let's go.
Done.
Sounds good. take it by the ribcage.
Take it that's by the ribcage.
Nice. And learn for yourself.
That's right.
I like also still learn everything that you have to learn to pass the exam.
Right.
Please pass.
Yes. We're not telling you don't study the important, necessary material. Get you the have foundation.
To. You have to know 75% of it.
That's right.
We don't want you to be DPT students for the rest of your life. We actually want you to be PT students, and then we can help guide and tell you which courses to take and how to be better PTs. And we'll talk a lot about residencies and mentorships in some upcoming episodes. Some cool people coming up.
I think too, that's actually one of the other tricky things is how to direct them towards good con ed, because there's a lot of not so good con ed out there. You know what I mean? So
you're being kind. There's a lot of very, very terrible con ed out there.
Yeah.
That are more cons trying to make money on ed.
It's really tricky. Nice. Like, it's
see
tricky
what I did there with the words? Yeah. Thank you.
And have a plan with your continuing education. You know, set up your plan.
Take courses willy-nilly.
Don't just take courses, for the love of God. Just, you know, figure out where you want to be and what you want to work on. Set up your 5-year plan and focus on doing something with your con ed. Don't just take the course that ends up in your mailbox.
Yeah, or in your town. Like, yeah. I have to wait till, and I get it. Like, it's expensive and all that stuff. But, you know, be willing to travel if you have to. You know, just, I don't know. It's tough. It's tough. But it's hard to help them find their way to good stuff. So
right. But it's an investment. It's an investment in what you'll be doing. And it's the same. It's ROI. What's the return on the investment that you're making? And sometimes you have to travel for that investment. And Joe, speaking like a clinic owner that probably covers some of continuing ed stuff, it's a waste of money if you know, new grads don't take recommendations seriously and just want to take things close by. That's a waste of your compensation package. And continuing ed, that's a big one, especially if it's offered.
Yeah, Joe, do you ever just say, one of your employees ever just say, oh, hey, I really want to take this course and I have some, you know, money left in my budget. What do you think? Do you just say, that's a really terrible idea because I hate those courses?
Yeah, you know, I try to be a little bit less blunt about it, but I want to know their plan. Why does it fit into their plan? And that's where I go back to, and how is that course gonna bring something to the clinic? Does it fit with our core programs that we try to promote? So, you know, really. Those are the questions that I throw back at them. And if they can't justify it, if the justification is just that it's in town, then, can't say that happens very often.
Yeah.
So don't be that person. Don't be that person that Joe just judges you after he gives you a nice politically correct answer. Which is very nice of him. Joe is a good boss and a good owner. If it was me, I would probably say, you're an idiot, get out of my face.
Well, I think one of the things that would be an interesting, like, litmus test, maybe the wrong word, but for anyone looking is, like, how is this going to help you be a better clinical decision maker? Like, how – because I think that's what a lot of people – they want a formula. I know this as a personally as someone who teaches Con Ed, you know – I get asked a lot, like, what would you do if the patient did this? And I would say, it depends. Like, you need to be like, what is, you know, could we do it like this? And I'll say, well, if what you want to do meets the goal that you have for your patient, then yes. But if it doesn't, then why are you going to do that? You know, like, just how do you become, like, I try really hard not to spoon feed anything in my Con Ed courses, but like, to like, just if, how do you build better clinical decision makers? Like, that's, to me, that would be the litmus test for how to pick a good course. Like, if you're going and you're getting like formulas, that won't work eventually. Like, someone will not fit the formula.
Right. It comes down to why, I think, Julie. It's that question is why. You ask somebody why and you ask them again. And if you ask them a third time and they can't really think through that answer, then you know they don't have a good answer. And that usually applies to most things. So people, there's always a superficial, and if you can get past the superficial, if there's something beyond it, then you have something sustainable. If not, you really have to really think about it.
Yeah, agreed.
And on that deep thought.
Yes.
Any closing thoughts? We'll start with first our guest.
Oh, shoot. Can somebody else start? I really appreciate you asking me to come. It's been a wonderful conversation. Is that not, were you looking for something more academic than that?
No, I was actually hoping you'd finish with an awesome quote, but.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to go there. Let's see.
What do you got?
Brothers don't shake hands. Brothers got a hug.
Oh my God. I'm hugging my microphone right now. Does that count?
That's pretty awesome. Gene, quit playing with your dinghy.
Oh, what? Wait, how did we go there?
Well, after 7 years of college education, I have absolutely no retort for that.
That's right. Well, isn't that one of the lines, though?
That is one of the lines.
That's really hard to come back from.
Well done, sir. Well done.
Nice.
I'm sure he's been saving that one for a little while.
That's Joe's closing thought, and it's a good one.
And it's a good one. All right, Urson.
I got nothing, actually.
Okay. So I was going to say save us, but so much for that. Well,
I was more of likely, I used to just fall through tables. You know, I would do Tommy Boy impressions physically.
You were visual learner and visual quoter.
Yes. Yes.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Fun to fall through tables. After you've had enough beers, it doesn't hurt.
There you go.
That day.
Right.
Right.
Mr. Pain.
Invincible
science.
In your 20s.
No brain, no pain.
There you go.
All right. Well, but Julie. Julie Weeb, Urson. That's Julie Weeb.
Jewel. Jewel.
There you go.
Weeb. Yeah.
I like it.
Thanks. Thanks a lot for joining us again. If our listeners want to find you or some of your material, what's a good place for them to reach you and or look
but
up
not at
stuff?
Her house.
Not yes, at my house.
Not at her yeah. house unless you want to be blindfolded, spun around the block three times, and then right. taken to her house.
It's all left turns. I've got lots of info that people can access via blog or videos at julieweebpt.com, and I have online courses and I teach live courses, so you can look at my event calendar and it's all there, julieweebpt.com.
There you go, check that out. We'll get all of Julie's stuff on our site as well, so you can click any of the links very easily to find her and her material, and she's got a bunch of cool stuff on YouTube too. And again, thanks for joining us once more, everybody listening. Thanks for bumping us up to 8 listeners, which is great. if you get a chance, please leave us a review on iTunes. It really helps us a lot, keeps us up in the rankings. A couple of weeks ago, we were number one medical podcast on iTunes, which is insane. Wow. So thank awesome. You for that. If you're driving, make a mental note when you pull over. Leave us a review. I know a lot of you said that you don't listen on iTunes, so we are on Stitcher and SoundCloud. So if you get a chance, any of those would be great. And catch us on at Therapy Insiders on Twitter. We've one of the coolest parts about these podcasts is the conversations we have on Twitter, which we'll continue to do. And if you haven't heard on our last podcast, Dr. Ben Fung will be joining us on UpDoc Media as our blogger and vlogger and helping us make content and share content. So we're quickly growing and taking up all the best PTs in the world that do social media. So that's the goal. And soon enough, I'm going to do my best to get Julie on as well. So
great interview, Julie.
Oh, thanks, guys. Well, I appreciate the conversation. Sorry,
we're gonna have to shut the door now and discuss. You can leave the room now. We'll just shut the door.
And speaking of that, let's shut the door and we are out. Thanks for listening.